Thanks. Yeah, so I'll talk about this topic mainly given my own viewpoint, of course. And it says part one here. I didn't really try to fit everything into one talk. So if by the end of this talk there is still sufficient interest, I would be most happy to give a part two next week or whenever. Especially since this part one is going to be a pretty unhappy story where we are really stuck and we need your help. But also the part two is a somewhat happier story, I would say, where we are making progress, but perhaps in a problem that we are not so interested in. The usual situation. Okay, so first let me thank my collaborators. First of all, my PhD advisor at Harvard, Subir Sachdev, Sentil at MIT, and Sentil's PhD student, David Moroz. Okay, so here's a brief outline of part one. I'll start with a brief introduction to critical Fermi surface states. And a particular realization of phase transitions in metals. Then I'll give a bit of experimental motivation. Here there might be some overlap with Joe's discussion yesterday. And really, I will not talk about experiments too much. We will have real experts on non-Fermi liquid behavior coming later in the program, experimental experts, and I hope we will hear from them. Then I will mention some other proposed realizations of critical Fermi surface states, which are physically, you know, the physical systems are quite different from those of phase transitions in metals, but turns out that the technology that we use to describe them is quite similar. Okay, then before plunging into critical Fermi surface states, I will give you a brief reminder of the modern RG treatment of ordinary Fermi liquid theory. And this perhaps will not be so important for today's talk. You will only perhaps see the contrast between the treatment of ordinary Fermi liquids and critical Fermi surface states. But in part two, Fermi liquid theory will come back to haunt us. Okay, and then at the end I will describe the theory of critical Fermi surface states, focusing primarily on the case of 2 plus 1 dimensions, where things are perhaps most strongly coupled. Notice that I have theory in quotation marks, because this is not a full theory at the moment, although I do think that we are perhaps on the right track. Okay, and then in part two, I would tell you, as I said, about progress on a somewhat deformed on a deformation of the problem that we are interested in, where we are making progress. And I'll also talk about pairing instabilities of critical Fermi surface states. Okay, so we know that in a not too strongly interacting metal, the excitations, the single particle excitations, are continuously connected to the non-interacting state, to the non-interacting electron gas, such that the electron Green's function at low energies and momentum close to the Fermi surface has the same characteristic pole structure as in a free electron gas, with the only difference being that the quasi-particle residue Z and the Fermi velocity Vf can be renormalized by the interaction. So this is Landau Fermi liquid. As I'll mention later, this is not the only property in Landau Fermi liquid theory. There are correlation functions of composite operators, which are quite non-trivial. But for the moment, this will do. Now, the question that has been asked is whether there exist states which do possess a sharp Fermi surface, but which do not have sharply defined Landau quasi-particles. So the Green's function doesn't have this form. And in one dimension, we know the answer. Such states exist, they are latent liquids, and not only do they exist, but they exist for arbitrarily weak interactions. So the Fermi liquid in one dimension is always unstable for arbitrarily weak interaction. However, and this is the form of the Green's function in a Lattinger liquid. However, the answer to the question of existence of critical Fermi surface states is still not completely settled in dimension larger than one, where ordinary Fermi liquids are stable for sufficiently weak interactions, at least if those are repulsive in the Cooper channel. Nevertheless, there have been several candidate critical Fermi surface states proposed, and here are the ones that that I will mention in my talk. Perhaps the simplest realization is that of phase transitions in metals, and the other examples that I'll mention are the so-called spin-on Fermi surface state in a modern insulator, and the composite fermion liquid in a half-filled Landau level in the quantum Hall effect context. But let me first start with this simplest example, just to give you a schematic picture of what's going to follow. So imagine that we start with some metal described by Fermi liquid theory, and then we tune some parameters such that it becomes favorable for some order to appear in this metal. I will talk about different types of orders that can appear in the next slide, but for now, suppose there is some order parameter phi describing this order, and an ordered metal can still be a metal, can still be described by Fermi liquid theory. So imagine a phase transition between two Fermi liquids, one disordered, one ordered, and then there is some quantum critical point in between. And although the two phases of Fermi liquid close to the phase transition, I expect the fluctuations of this order parameter to be strong, particularly if we are in low enough dimension. Then these fluctuations will couple to the electron quasi-particles near the Fermi surface, decohering them and leading to non-Fermi liquid behavior. So roughly, these types of transitions can be divided into two classes, depending on whether the order parameter has zero wave vector or a finite wave vector. That is, whether the order breaks translational symmetry of the lattice or not. So the first class, some examples are a ferromagnet, where we just have a uniform spin moment, and the pneumatic. I will talk about what a pneumatic is in a few slides. Some typical examples in the second class are charge density wave. Here the density is modulated with some wave vector, and a spin density wave where the spin is modulated with some wave vector. And the reason for division into two classes is that the order parameter fluctuations couple somewhat differently to the electron quasi-particles in the two classes. In the first class, order parameter fluctuations can effectively scatter electrons everywhere on the Fermi surface, leaving them on the Fermi surface because their wave vector is zero. So one expects the entire Fermi surface, one expects to get non-Fermi liquid behavior on the entire Fermi surface. Whereas in the second class, the order parameter fluctuations couple most strongly to a discrete set of points on the Fermi surface, known as the hotspots. These are the points which are connected to the ordering wave by the ordering wave vector, and that's where one expects to get the strongest non-Fermi liquid singularities. Although in principle, it is possible that weaker singularities also appear on the rest of the Fermi surface. And in my talk, I will be primarily talking about this class of transitions. They seem to be somewhat simpler, and they are also related to the other problems that that I've mentioned. Okay, so let me now talk briefly about the experimental motivation for studying critical Fermi surface states and perhaps phase transitions in metals. So Joe already mentioned this a little bit yesterday. So the motivation comes primarily from the so-called strange metal physics, which is observed in many compounds, and perhaps most famously in the cuprate superconductors. So you know about the cuprates, they're quasi-two-dimensional compounds with a typical phase diagram shown here, where at large, so the parent compound is actually not a metal, it's an insulator, which happens to be also antiferromagnetically ordered, whereas when one dopes these compounds with holes or electrons, at sufficiently large doping, one gets a fairly conventional Fermi liquid, and the high temperature superconductor is in between. And perhaps the most mysterious region of this phase diagram is the strange metal region, whose perhaps most famous characteristic is that the resistivity grows linearly with temperature. And this, this region of linear resistivity is very robust. It stretches from TC all the way up to 600 or 1000 Kelvin, depending on the compound. And TC can be from 40 Kelvin to 100 something Kelvin. So it's a pretty large range. And also it turns out that if one suppresses the superconductivity with the magnetic field, then this linear region actually stretches all the way down to a few Kelvin. It's quite robust. Now, so this linear resistivity should be compared to standard T squared resistivity in a Fermi liquid with umklapps. So just to remind you, umklapps are processes where momentum is conserved only modular reciprocal lattice vector. Okay, so some other strange properties of the strange metal. For example, the optical conductivity goes at some strange power of frequency with an exponent being roughly 2/3. Whereas in a Fermi liquid with umklapps, one expects the optical conductivity to just go to a constant.
How universal is that optical conductivity result?
These are fairly recent, I think, experiments in the 2000s, past 10 years. I don't know. They don't seem to have been made on too many compounds. And I also don't think, this linear resistivity I'll show in a moment. Other materials not from the cuprate family, which have a linear resistivity, optical conductivity I don't think has been studied as much in other materials. Also, so this is really optical, so it's in the regime when omega is much larger than t. In the regime when omega is of order of t, one seems to have a different power law, more like one over omega and then some scaling function of omega over t.
What are the
rules
of the three results?
Okay, so one has to be careful. So if you have just a Fermi liquid, then Landau theory will tell you that sigma of omega is equal to I omega plus I eta. So the imaginary part is I over omega, and then there is a delta function at zero frequency. And this, of course, has to be multiplied by number, which is the Drude weight. And if you just had a Galilean invariant system, then this Drude weight would be just the density over the mass. And in fact, if you had a Galilean invariant system, even with interactions, then this would be your full answer. Period, there would be no other correction. So you see that the imaginary part of the conductivity goes as 1 over omega in a Landau Fermi liquid. The real part has a delta function at zero frequency, and then at leading order is zero for finite frequency. So if I want now to calculate the real part, the dissipative part of the real of the conductivity at finite frequency, I need interactions. You know, in a free theory doesn't have interactions, so there is no way to dissipate. And then if I put in interactions, and it's actually crucial to put in umklapp scattering. If you don't have umklapp scattering, then the real part of the optical conductivity goes as some power of omega, and actually I haven't been able to find the power in the literature. But if you so it's actually an interesting problem to calculate what is this power. Is it 2 or 1? It's at least, you know, one definitely has omega squared. The question is whether one has just omega. But if one does have umklapps, then this goes as a constant.
At high omega.
At omega much larger than T. So at zero temperature, it happens at any.
This is a spreading out of the delta function.
This is not a spreading out of the delta function. So at zero temperature, so if you are strictly at zero temperature, there is always, and let's plot only the real part of the conductivity. At zero temperature, there is always a delta function if there is no disorder, no matter what you do. And then if you have umklapps, you have this finite part, and maybe later that's something else. And now if you turn on temperature, then this delta function, if you have umklapps, will be broadened to a t squared here, omega, then there is some funny crossover behavior here between t squared and t, and then, okay, here it's constant. And conductivity is 1 over t squared.
Max, you made this point about linear resistivity being seen over a very wide range, mm-hmm. temperatures and maybe also dopings. Is it ever seen in the same regime of temperatures and dopings where the quantum oscillation experiments are done?
I don't think so. I don't think... Typically, the quantum oscillations are done in the underdoped regime and also at low temperatures, because if you have high temperature, then the oscillations are washed out. Okay, so the resistivity and the DC resistivity and the optical conductivity are somewhat indirect probes of non-permaliquid behavior. Let's try to connect more directly to the, you know, to the Green's function, what I have been talking about in the beginning. So how do we measure the Green's function? Well, we do photoemission experiments. Well, we don't do. So people take a metal, cleave a nice surface, and then shine X-rays on this surface. These X-rays get absorbed, and an electron is kicked out, and then this electron is detected with a detector here. And what's left here is some excited state of the system with one electron less. And essentially, if you calculate the intensity of these outcoming electrons, it turns out to be proportional to the imaginary part of the retarded Green's function, because you're just measuring the amplitude to extract an electron in some sense. So when one looks at the results of these ARPAS experiments in the strange metal region, one finds very broad peaks in the imaginary part of the Green's function. And if you try to quantify how broad they are, it seems that their width, at least in momentum, grows linearly with frequency or temperature. That is, the width of these quasi-particles is as large as their energy. You can also, there are some clever experiments that are done on this Fermi-liquid side, where, you know, you start with fairly well-defined quasi-particles, narrow peaks, and then you raise the temperature. And it looks like the quasi-particle residue is actually going to zero as you cross over into this strange metal regime as defined by the resistivity. So the place where you cross over from T squared resistivity to T linear resistivity seems to roughly coincide with the place where the quasi-particle residue is going to zero. So this is more direct direct evidence that there is some kind of disappearance of quasi-particle. So, okay, and as I said, this... it's huge. So T is of order of 0.5 electron volts, and then, you know, the bandwidth is even larger than that. So these are like tens of, something like 10,000 Kelvin. So as for 1,000 Kelvin, as usual in condensed matter, you typically melt the material before you reach the Fermi energy scale. Okay. So as I said, this strange metal behavior, at least from the resistivity viewpoint, is very ubiquitous. So here, you know, it occurs in other compounds. Here, for example, I have shown an organic compound and a so-called iron nictide superconductor, and all of these seem to have fairly similar phase diagrams. So there is some metallic state, either as a function of concentration or pressure here. And then on the other side, one has an antiferromagnetically or spin density wave order state. Here these states are not insulating, but rather metallic in these compounds. And in between there is a superconducting dome. And above the superconducting dome, one sees a region of collinear resistivity. So here are some plots of the resistivity. This is on the log scale. But basically, you see that these are three compounds. This is a cuprate superconductor. This is this organic, and this is this iron nictide. So you see they look very similar, at least if you plot them on the log scale. So at large doping here, one has a resistivity that basically goes as T squared, and then at around optimal doping, one has T linear, and then at small doping, something strange happens.
And interpolates by T plus some coefficient times T squared, or is that?
Yeah, that's how people fit these things, and it's still there is a bit of a mystery, particularly in the cuprates. This is a bit of an embarrassment for the theory that I'm going to tell you next about. But from the physics point of view, this is very interesting. So in particular, in the cuprate, there are these experiments where you take the superconductor and you suppress superconductivity with a large magnetic field. And then you draw a resistivity, and you look at where does the resistivity grow linearly. And it does grow linearly here in this funnel region that we know about in the presence of superconductivity. But also, there seems to be like a foot here. You know, these pictures look like an X-ray of a leg. So it looks like there is this region where you have the linear resistivity here, at least at optimal doping. The slope is roughly the same all the way down to zero temperature. But then there are additional regions here of linear resistivity with the coefficient changing as you change the doping. So it's quite mysterious, and it's not clear. Maybe once one suppresses this superconductor, there is also not only some kind of a critical point that I will tell you about shortly, but perhaps even a critical phase here in this range of dopings.
Are there any times where there's a phase transition from the T squared to the T behavior, or is this always a crossover from the transformation?
Yeah, it's a crossover. Well, it's not even clear how one can have a phase transition. I mean, at zero temperature, one can have, in principle, a phase transition from T squared to T linear. But at finite temperature, how do you even define?
If you go first order, you could see other things.
Yeah, with the first order, you could see a jump in there.
Some of your crossover lines seem to be coming down almost all the way to zero temperature, avoid the dome. The pictures you get plotted, it looks like this. So, your pieces seem to be coming very close to.
You mean here? You mean
the dome or the...
So this is the story that I just told you about, that once you suppress the superconductor, it looks like you have linear resistivity in this whole region, and then here it is lost and you have Q squared.
But even without the magnetic field, that's...
Yes, I think all of this are done in a large, or at least I think this is done in a large magnetic field. So even though the superconductor is drawn, and then here really, you know, if you have something that goes as T plus T squared, it is T linear at small temperature and it is T squared at large temperature. So in this way it's continuous in that sense.
Material
TMTS. This is an organic material.
This is
some organic molecule, and actually this is a quasi 1D material. So there are chains of these molecules, and then at some temperature, which I believe is around 100 Kelvin, these chains become two-dimensional, roughly, the reception tunneling, so that the material should be thought of as two-dimensional, and then still at much lower temperatures, it becomes effectively three-dimensional. But in this regime, it might be okay to think of the material as quasi two-dimensional. Okay, so. One scenario that has been proposed to try to explain the above puzzling experiments is that there is a quantum critical point in the underlying metallic phase of these materials hidden underneath the superconducting dome, and that this critical point is associated with an onset of some order. Now, in reality, the critical point is not directly accessible, as it is hidden by the superconductor, and there, you know, it's a fundamental question in my mind whether this superconducting instability is inherent to such quantum critical points, because in almost all the materials one does see a small to largish superconducting dome around the critical point. So whether this is an inherent instability of a phase transition in a metal is in my mind a very interesting question, and I'll try to answer this question in part two of my talk. So if it's a phase transition associated with onset of some order parameter, we should say what that order is. So one candidate, which is quite natural, is this spin density wave or antiferromagnetic order, and it's particularly natural for electron-doped cuprates, the nictites, and the organics, where this SDW order is observed close to the strange metal region, close to optimal doping. In hole-doped cuprates, you have to work a little harder to realize this scenario, because really, static spin density wave order is not observed all the way up to optimal doping. So you have to then, one possibility is that perhaps the onset of superconductivity is what drives the actual observed spin density wave transition to smaller doping in the whole doping rate. Another scenario that has been proposed is that of a pneumatic transition, where the order that onsets at around optimal doping is pneumatic order. So what is pneumatic order? Pneumatic order is an order that doesn't break the translational symmetry of the lattice, but breaks the point group symmetry, so rotational symmetry. So if we are in two dimensions on a square lattice, then this is just breaking of 90 degree rotational symmetry. and one can introduce a corresponding Ising order parameter phi. And typically, when this when such order appears in the metallic state, we call this transition a Pomeranchik transition of Pomeranchik instability. Now, such pneumatic order is actually observed in the before I go to experiments, here is a cartoon picture. I start in a metal where there is no pneumatic order. The Fermi surface has the 90 degree rotational symmetry of the lattice, and then as I tune some parameter, the Fermi surface distorts. And there are two states, which are two ground states, which are related by symmetry, one with elongation along one direction and along the other direction. And these have opposite orders, opposite values of the order parameter. So now, the pneumatic order is actually absorbed in cuprates on the underdoped side. Here are some plots, not of the Fermi surfaces, but of the spin structure factor. So this is essentially spin correlation function at finite wave vector at different energies. And you see that you start with something fairly isotropic in momentum space, and then as you go to lower and lower energy, you find a distinct anisotropy. So the pneumatic order is absorbed in underdoped cuprates, and perhaps one can associate the strange metal region with this transition from an ordinary metal to a pneumatically ordered metal. And I will use the pneumatic transition as a kind of prototype in my discussion of phase transitions in metals in the rest of the talk. So there are some caveats that should be mentioned regarding this scenario of a quantum phase transition and then the superconducting dome. And these caveats, I think, apply most strongly to the cuprates. And the problem is that in this scenario, the ordered state is a Fermi liquid. And in the cuprates, the state that we have at a small doping is really not a Fermi liquid. It's what people call the pseudogap. And the pseudogap is another mystery in the cuprate superconductors. And some people think that this pseudogap has to do with proximity to the underlying parent Mott insulator at zero doping. And if you go from a metal to an insulator, then you have much more drastic changes in your Fermi surface. Essentially, the Fermi surface disappears compared to what happens at a phase transition where some order onsets. You still have a well-defined Fermi surface here, perhaps somewhat distorted. So perhaps it should be really, from this perspective, we might have to be thinking about metal insulator transition rather than onset of order in a metal. And similar complaints have been raised about the other family of compounds where strange metal behavior is seen, the so-called heavy fermion compounds, where across the quantum critical point, one goes from a state which essentially, one essentially completely loses one Fermi surface. One of the bands becomes insulating. So in that case, again, there might be additional physics that one has to put in order to describe the transition, not captured by this simple kind of Landau description of an order parameter coupled to the Fermi surface. However, this simplest description might be okay for some less strongly correlated systems like electron-doped cuprates, the nictites, and the organics. And above all, it's a simple theoretical model where it seems like some kind of non-Fermi liquid physics is emerging. So from a theoretical standpoint, it's fairly clean and interesting to study.
Yes. strongly correlated? Can you quantify that?
Well, so for example, there is no pseudogap phase observed or pseudogap region observed in those materials. And also those material, the parent compounds there are typically metallic rather than insulating.
Sorry, what is exactly the characterization of the pseudogap phase?
So there are many features. The earliest, the ones which were discovered earliest, I guess, are, say you look at uniform susceptibility. So spin-spin correlation function at zero y vector, and as a function of temperature, you know, this looks something like this, where there is a crossover scale of maybe something like 300 Kelvin. So in an ordinary thermoliquid, the susceptibility goes to a constant at low temperature. But here, as you cross this boundary, and this might be a phase transition or a crossover, it's not quite clear. It seems like the susceptibility is going down quite strongly, which in some sense means that you are losing carriers, you are losing quasiparticles. There are other signatures, I think, in specific heat as well. Something similar happens. Also, if you actually do angular resolved photoemission experiments and look at the Green's function, it looks. People talk about these Fermi arcs, where. So if this is the Brillouin zone. So, okay. So in overdoped and optimally doped cuprates, if you look at the Fermi surface, it looks roughly like this. And this is what is basically predicted by local density approximation. So if you do, if you try to predict what would the Fermi surface look like without interactions, that's what it looks like, and that's what's seen in experiments. But as you go on the underdoped side, it looks like these portions of the Fermi surface are gapped, and one still has gapless excitations in these arc-like regions. It's not even clear how can one have an arc of gapless excitations. So this is very mysterious.
So that's where the pseudogap comes from.
That's why people call. Well, I think pseudogap was probably the term pseudogap was probably named before these experiments, because when you look at the susceptibility and the specific heat, it looks like part of the Fermi surface is being gapped out. You're losing carriers.
That's a transition from the strange metal.
Yes. But there seems to be some notion of a Fermi surface, of a sharp Fermi surface still.
It seems like from an outsider's point of view, it's the superconducting region that's the most interesting. But from what you're just describing, feels like the superconducting region is just an annoyance, and what's really interesting is this quantum critical.
I think that's true. Now, the superconductor is a fairly conventional, in some sense, when you go to low energies, it's a fairly conventional superconductor. You know, there are gaps on the, so it's a D-wave superconductor, which means that you have a gap everywhere except in these nonal points. But we know how to explain that without, you know, invoking any kind of exotic physics. And then, you know, the properties, so there are Dirac fermions sitting at these nodal points, and they give some low, interesting low energy properties, but those have been measured and a pretty good agreement with theory. So the superconductor itself is not very, very strange, except for the fact that critical temperature is rather high.
But if you put it in a high magnetic field, can you then get close and see the critical point?
Yes, so you can see the linear T resistivity down to very low temperatures of about 1 Kelvin. But also, as I just described, there seems to be other complications in this large magnetic field. You see linear T resistivity not only in this funnel-like region, as you would expect, but also in these foot regions.
You don't see that.
You don't quite see this.
I have a very naive question. You said it was difficult to get gapless excitations just on arcs. What is that?
Well, what would happen at the border? Well, what happens at the border of the arc? But you know, if you think about Fermi surfaces are always closed, right? So what does it mean to have an open Fermi arc?
There'd be some scattering where the gap would sort of propagate around the whole circuit, right? I mean, it's sort of like an advanced gap.
If you
got one, you can call the whole thing sort of gap because all of the space mix.
Well, at least if it's some kind of superconducting gap, I guess. One possibility is that so what happens at the spin density wave transition? What they showed. So that's that's where you have these hotspots. And then at the phase transition, you have this non-Fermi liquid behavior at the hotspots. And then what happens once you go into the ordered phase is that the Fermi surface actually breaks here along the hotspots. And here you have a gap at the hotspot, and then you also have this kind of pockets forming here. But again, it's a closed pocket in this case. So this side really comes from here, because now you doubled your unit cell, so really it's a smaller unit cell in momentum space. But you see that you don't really get arcs, you get a whole pocket. Now maybe in experiments, the weight on this backside is very small because you don't have very much. So what causes this pocket is that you have some order parameter setting on which mixes quasi particles essentially here and here. So maybe that mixing is very small, so the weight here is very small, so that's why you don't really see it in experiments. But it's not clear that this is the right. Yes?
So as you move from the pseudo gap into the superconductor phase, do the Fermi arcs just continuously shrink until you're left with points?
So once you're, yeah, I think that's right.
Just one small comment about the Fermi arcs. The Fermi arcs point you. Suppose you just write down you can write down a non-interacting Hamiltonian which has Fermi arcs. You can force in a way. Write down a band structure which, but it won't be stable. There's no. If you try to force some kind of Fermi arc, generally you would think that there's no protection. Argument you can make.
No protection from.
For a Fermi surface, for a closed Fermi surface, one can define that as a topological invariant. Like Borovic, if you read Borovic's papers, he defines some kind of topological invariant for a closed Fermi surface. But you can't use that if you have some kind of open Fermi surface. So, in some sense, that's why, if you do any kind of mean tube theory, or spin density or something, you always try to find things just close. That's not a proof, but generally you can define some kind of topological invariant closed Fermi surface. In two dimensions. But they are in three dimensions, there are cases where you can get Fermi arcs on the surface of Earth. So.
But that's not, not in the bulk.
Not in the bulk.
Okay. So this concludes the overview of experiments. I don't know if we're going to get to theory. Okay, but I think, you know, let me, even though we're running out of time, let me mention this, these other realizations of critical Fermi surface states, which are totally very different, but in terms of their theoretical description, they seem to be quite similar. The first realization that I want to talk about is so-called spin-on Fermi surface state in the spin-liquid context. So these are no longer metals. These are now insulators that we are talking about. Resistivity is infinite. And so what are spin-liquids? More generally, spin-liquids are not insulators with an odd number of electrons per unit cell and no symmetry breaking. So no, neither magnetic order nor any breaking of the lattice symmetry. And you know, since these are insulators, the charge degrees of freedom are gapped, so I can describe the system in terms of spin degrees of freedom. So let me write down some spin Hamiltonian, and if I'm deep in the insulating regime, when my repulsion, when my interactions are much larger than my kinetic energy, then this spin Hamiltonian will just be Heisenberg Hamiltonian. And very often, if your lattice at least is not too geometrically frustrated, the ground state of this Hamiltonian will be an ordered state where the spins order. However, if I now increase the ratio of kinetic energy to repulsion, additional terms appear in this Hamiltonian, which become progressively more important as one approaches the insulator metal transition. And these additional terms might cause new states of matter, in particular, this kind of spin-liquid state. So these additional terms, they frustrate the order of the spins. So there are many kinds of spin-liquids, but the ones that I'll describe can be obtained in the following way. So I'll start with my spin operators on each side, and I will fractionalize them into fermionic spin 1/2 operators, which I'll call spinons. Now, any such description is invariant under local phase rotations of this fermion operator. So any low energy description will necessarily involve a U1 gauge field. Now, being fermions, the spinons like to form a Fermi surface. However, the excitations of this Fermi surface will not be Landau quasiparticles due to the presence of gauge field fluctuations, which will decohere my spinons. And actually, such a spinon Fermi surface state is a candidate for a state which is observed by exact diagonalization calculations of the triangular lattice Hubbert model in an intermediate range of repulsion over kinetic energy. So the exact diagonalization calculations can be interpreted in terms of such a state. I guess not really experimentally observed. But also such a state might be, as it has been suggested, to be relevant to the organic material which has an infinitely long name that everybody just calls DMIT.
You don't have sign problems when you do that Hubbert model?
You do have sign problems. That's why people can't do Monte Carlo. They have to do exact diagonalization. So it's fairly... I think 30 spins, something of that order. So first... Actually, to do that, to do these simulations, they first go from electrons to spins, because that reduces the number of degrees of freedom, and they actually write down this effective Hamiltonian to something like sixth order or some ridiculous order in T over U, and then they do exact diagonalization on the spin Hamiltonian. This is work by Andreas Lachley. And then you know, the excitations of the state, of the ground state that you get, you can kind of interpret in terms of spin-ons around the Fermi surface. It looks like kind of basically particle Hall pairs. In terms of momentum values, looks quite good. Of course, you know, so such small system sizes, you definitely cannot see any critical aspect of the Fermi surface. Okay, so now let me switch to yet another example, which again is physically very different. This is quantum Hall system. So I'm thinking about fermions in a half-filled Landau level. And you know that in quantum Hall, you often see plateaus in the in the Hall conductivity. But at half filling, no plateau is seen. So how can one explain this? So that means that the state is not incompressible. It's a compressible state. So how can we explain such a state? So the idea has been proposed by Halpin, Lee, and Reed in 1993. So let's do the following. So first of all, the kinetic energy of electrons is completely quenched here by the presence of the magnetic field. It's just a flat band, and everything comes from the interactions. But let us do the following construction. Let us, to each electron, attach two flux quanta. And I'll call the resulting quasi-particles composite fermions. And now such composite fermions see no net magnetic field, and since they see no net magnetic field, they like to form a Fermi surface. And at the technical level, this procedure of attaching flux to electrons is performed with the help of a U1 Chern-Simons gauge field, little a, which basically enforces the constraint that the flux of this Chern-Simons gauge field is equal to the electron density. So then, on average, this emergent gauge field will cancel out the external magnetic flux, but there are so that the electrons see no net magnetic flux on average and form a Fermi surface, but there are still fluctuations of this emergent gauge field left. And these fluctuations will couple to the Fermi surface and will lead to kind of non-Fermi liquid behavior, but now of this composite fermion.
So the previous example was a Maxwell action, and here it's a Chern-Simons action, so the fluctuations are weaker here, but still pretty lower.
Actually, in terms of the effective theory, it turns out not to matter. You would think that there would be a difference. But actually, the presence of the Fermi surface screens out the electric fields, and that's... Okay, so these are the three examples of critical Fermi surface states that I've discussed. Physically, they're quite different, but from theoretical viewpoints, they all involve an interaction of a Fermi surface with a gapless boson. And as I'll try to convince you in the rest of this talk, this is a difficult problem. And it's difficult for technical reasons, but also, I think, for a conceptual reason, that we don't have a very good RG program for this problem. Now, in the early 90s, this problem was basically declared solved, at least in the large N limit. However, it has been declared open again after the work of Sang-Sik a few years ago, and actually I kind of feel bad about giving this talk because I feel like Sang-Sik should be actually giving it, given the number of results from his paper that I'm going to cite. Okay, so before we plunge into the problems with critical Fermi surface states, let me give you a very brief review of ordinary Fermi liquid theory in a modern language. So how do we describe ordinary Fermi liquid? Well, as the first step, we start with a thin shell of electrons around the Fermi surface, and at the outset we integrate all the other states out, and then in the RG process we integrate out slices, thin shells in momentum space around the Fermi surface, and then rescale momenta back so that the Fermi surface comes back to it, so that this cutoff comes back to its original value, and rescale the fields accordingly. We rescale the fields in such a way as to leave the quadratic part of the action invariant. Notice that here only the direction of momentum perpendicular to the Fermi surface is scaled, and not the angle around the Fermi surface. Now one can think about perturbations to this action, and the lowest ones are Fermi interactions, and it turns out that there are only two types of Fermi interactions which keep electrons on the Fermi surface, so-called forward scattering processes. Forward scattering because here the momentum, the direction of momentum is basically conserved, and BCS scattering where two particles collide with zero net momentum. And one can decompose these interactions into charge and spin channels. This will not be very important. But turns out that both of these types of interactions are marginal at tree level. But one can look at quantum corrections. And it's simplest to write down flow equations if one has rotational symmetry around the Fermi surface, although it can be done more generally. So if one does have rotational symmetry, then one can go to this angular momentum components here. So then the flow equations become as follows. To one loop, one finds that the forward scattering interactions are marginal, still marginal, and the BCS scattering interactions acquire this flow. Now it turns out that these flow equations are exact to all orders. So forward scattering interactions remain marginal to all orders, whereas in the BCS channel we have this familiar story that repulsive interactions are marginally irrelevant, whereas attractive interactions are marginally relevant, and this is interpreted as attractive interactions leading to pairing of electrons with a gap scales in the following way. So now, if we start with repulsive interaction, BCS interactions in all channels, then we flow to this Fermi-liquid fixed point, and turns out that this fixed point theory is actually exactly solvable. There's only one series of diagrams that I basically have to compute. So I can compute both the Fermion-Green's function and the composite correlators. Now, the Fermion-Green's function in Fermi-liquid theory is very boring. It's the same as the Green's function of a non-interacting theory, which means that in a Fermi-liquid, in Landau, you know, at this, in the fixed point theory, quasi-particles have an infinitely long lifetime. And in order to get a lifetime for these quasi-particles, we have to include irrelevant operators. And then if we calculate the lifetime in a two-dimensional Fermi-liquid, it is given by this omega squared log omega expression, which is much smaller than the quasiparticle energy, so the quasiparticles are well defined. Now, I would really like to draw your attention to this log. I don't think one can explain the presence of this log in a simple RG description that I just mentioned. This log really has, in a sense, the same origin as many of the singularities that appear in the case of critical Fermi surfaces, singularities associated with small angle forward and back scattering. And I think a consistent treatment of this log in an RG sense would be very nice. We know exactly what the coefficient in front of this log is, but it would be good to interpret this log in an RG language.
It's not there in 3 plus 1. It's just
in 3 plus 1, one has similar problem, but at a higher level. If one goes, there is an omega cubed log omega term. So in 3 plus 1, there is I omega squared sine omega, and then yet at a higher order, one again runs into this log.
Is there an RG interpretation of chiral log?
Of
chiral logarithm? Looks like a chiral, the logarithmic chiral equation theory. It's similar to this one. In a sense, it's come from a loop graph. Here you're computing a loop graph to cut.
Yes.
Is there?
I think.
Or it is a different. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Maybe it's.
It is a loop graph. You're right. So.
Logarithm is the imaginary part.
So you're just computing this graph. You can get this logarithm already at this order. And the logarithm. So generally, you know, this is k. Yes, let's say we are doing forward scattering, so k prime yes, so generally this logarithm comes from the regime when k prime goes close to k, small angle scattering. So generally, how can we, you know, if you think about it, how can we get a logarithm from some, you know, in some subleading corrections? One would have to think that there are two operators which have the same scaling dimension at tree level, and then they mix, but they mix in such a way that the eigenvalues remain unsplit. And then, so imagine that you have a flow like this, alpha, beta. I think this will do it. Correct me if I'm wrong. You know, this matrix still has eigenvalue equal to 1, and then I think one can have a logarithm. But here, it's not exactly clear where the mixing is coming from. Well, there are some thoughts on this issue. So there are two different scaling limits that one can write. One is associated with the limit where you make the angle go to zero between the scatter between k and k prime, and the other is the usual scaling limit where one scales momenta towards the Fermi surface. And it seems like perturbations in these two scaling limits mix with each other. And that's where the log comes from. But it would be nice to have a more precise picture. Any other question? Okay, so we see that even Fermi liquid theory is already quite non-trivial. So now let's discuss critical Fermi surface states. And as an example, let me use. So we discussed the examples that that we have are theories of gapless bosons interacting with the Fermi surface. As an example, let me illustrate everything with this U1 spin liquid, this U1 gauge field coupled to the spin-on Fermi surface problem. I will indicate where changes are needed for the case of a pneumatic phase transition or half-filled Landau level problem. But let me stick with this for now. So to gain some intuition about the problem, let me begin by doing RPA for the photon propagator. So let me just calculate this fermion loop and the associated polarization function for the gauge field. I will work on this Coulomb gauge. It will be convenient. So we know that the temporal part of the correlator goes to a constant in this particular limit, which is associated with the fact that electric fields are Debye screened in the presence of a Fermi surface in a metal. Electric field fluctuations are gapped. On the other hand, if I look at the spatial part here of the polarization function, I don't have a gap. I have a much more intricate form, which is known as Landau damping. So magnetic field fluctuations in the presence of a Fermi surface remain gapless and disperse. They're damped, and if one tries to think about, you know, how does the momentum scale with energy, one arrives at the dynamical exponent being equal to 3 from here. So these are very soft magnetic field fluctuations. And in the remainder of my talk, I will discuss how these soft magnetic field fluctuations couple to the Fermi surface. Now, in a very simple-minded calculation, one can think about how do these fluctuations feed back on the fermions. And just from this one loop graph, one obtains a fermion self-energy that goes at omega to the 2/3. And at low energies, this is much more relevant than the tree level, than the term in the Green's function that we started with. So this omega to the 2/3 describes a non-Fermi liquid. So what is the reason that we have this strange non-Fermi liquid behavior? What is so different here compared to an ordinary Fermi liquid, to a setup, to a theory of an ordinary Fermi liquid? Well, what's different is that here, if we try to write down Landau parameters, these are singular at small angles. There is singular forward scattering and back scattering going on. And that's what gives rise to this non-Fermi liquid behavior. And in the remainder of my talk, I will try to zoom in on this small angle scattering singularity. There is one note of caution that I'd like to raise. This is fairly technical, but I think important. So it looks like this self-energy is only frequency dependent. One note of caution is that we'll see at high loop order that momentum-dependent singular corrections do start to appear once one is at three loop order. And also, even at this one loop order, really this form is correct only if the energy is much larger than k cubed, where k stands for the deviation from the Fermi surface. Which is an okay assumption, because if one looks at this Green's function with the singular self-energy included, then typical energy scales as k to the 3/2, which is much larger than k cubed. Nevertheless, just if one looks at the opposite regime of this diagram, then one gets a self-energy whose scaling with frequency is much more regular. So in a sense, if you think about it, if you have a fermion which is not on the Fermi surface and you send the energy to zero, it's very unlikely that it's going to have this kind of very strong non-Fermi liquid singularity, because that fermion is in some sense high energy fermion. Okay. So now that we've done this preliminary calculation, let's try to build a scaling theory of this problem. And the zeroth order question, which is still not fully resolved, is how should you scale? So the gauge field would indicate that we should scale all momenta to zero, as we do in ordinary relativistic field theories, or theories of ordinary critical phenomena in Stepneck. But the fermions indicate that we should scale momenta towards the Fermi surface, where only the distance to the Fermi surface is scaled, but not the angle. So how do we marry these two scalings? And now I'll describe one way to marry them. And so here, the intuition about this goes back a long time to work of Joe Polchinski. So it turns out that if we think about gauge fluctuations with a given direction of momentum, these fluctuations couple most strongly to two patches of the Fermi surface to which this momentum is tangent. And the reason for this is the following. So the main reason is that the order parameter fluctuations are very soft. So if I have an electron sitting here on the Fermi surface, and I come in with a photon with some wave vector and energy, and the direction of this wave vector is just arbitrary, then the energy generally scales as q cubed for the photon, and the electron gets a kick in its kinetic energy, which is of order of vfq, because there is some angle here, so okay, sine theta. Now q goes as omega to 1/3, so this kick is of order omega to 1/3. Now the self-energy that we just computed is of order omega to 2/3. So you're giving the electron a much larger kick than it can absorb. So these kind of processes are not going to scatter electrons very effectively. On the other hand, if you're coming in nearly tangent to the Fermi surface, then you change the electron energy by something of order q squared. Now q squared is of order omega to the 2/3, which is exactly the self-energy. So here there is this exact matching. The gauge field and the electron are perfectly matched to interact. And that's why they interact strongly. Or maybe it's the other way around. They interact strongly, and that's why they're exactly matched. And actually, such a conspiracy is unique to 2+1 dimensions. In high dimensions, it doesn't occur, and the theory is believed to be coupled much more weakly.
In higher dimensions, there's non-stability.
Pardon me?
Non-stability.
In higher dimensions, so at least in 3 dimensions, one gets I omega log lambda over omega, but it's generally believed that this result is actually exact. That the high order corrections go as higher powers of omega. And I think in dimension, if one tries to extrapolate, then in dimension larger than 2, one gets d over 3. Again, the corrections that go as some higher powers of omega. So the fact that the corrections go as higher powers of omega has been argued, for example, in the context of dense quark matter in papers by Thomas Schaffer. But I think it's still a good problem to revisit and think more about. Okay. So now, based on the above intuition, let me do the following construction. Let me start with the Fermi surface and divide it into pairs of antipodal patches. And I'm going to write a separate theory for each pair of patches, with the fermions in the two patches interacting with gauge field fluctuations whose momentum is nearly tangent to the patch. So now, focusing on a pair of patches, let me introduce points k naught and minus k naught in each patch and expand the fermion fields around those points, introducing fields F plus and F minus, and I'm going to expand the fermion dispersion around those points. And it's crucial in this expansion to keep the Fermi surface curvature. Now, I also have gauge field fluctuations, and here I have introduced a field A which has no indices, so this is just the transverse component of a of the vector gauge field in the Coulomb gauge. Okay, and then finally these gauge field fluctuations couple to the electrons in the to the spinons in the two patches, and notice that they couple with opposite sign to the two patches, and that's because vector field couples to the current, and the current is opposite on the opposite sides of the Fermi surface. So each two patch theory is a local 2 plus 1 dimensional theory. All fields depend on the direction perpendicular to the Fermi surface, direction tangent to the Fermi surface, and time. And I have a large set of this of these theories. And as I let the energy go to zero, I have more and more of this. I need more and more of these patches to cover the Fermi surface. So in some sense, the patches, the theories become dense in the low energy limit, and I get a kind of extra dimension which parameterizes the direction around the Fermi surface. So now that I have made a crucial assumption that one can actually neglect the coupling between different patches. And it seems that for the things that I'll discuss in my talk today, this assumption is correct. However, for some other problems, like the problem of pairing of these quasi-particles, it's not enough to just think about two-patch problem. One really has to start including couplings between patches. And that's what I propose to discuss in part two of my talk. So the fact that we get this 2 plus 1 dimensional local theory is again quite unique to two dimensions. Because if I think about two dimensions, you know, if I focus on fermions in a patch, then these fermions are decohered by order parameter fluctuations whose wave vector is tangent to the patch. But these gauge field fluctuations, I'll endow them again by these same two patches. So that gives rise to a local field theory that turns out to be strongly coupled. Now, if one is in higher dimensions, and if I focus on fermions in a patch, again, these fermions are decohered by gauge fluctuations whose momentum is tangent to the Fermi surface, to the patch. However, these gauge fluctuations are now Landau-damped down by a whole circle of patches on the Fermi surface. So I don't know how to write a local description down here. And the effective non-local theory that one can think about turns out to be weakly coupled. Okay, so I have this local two-patch theory. Let me think about how to do scaling on this theory. And let me first discuss how you scale momentum. So the natural thing is to scale momentum as dictated by this fermion kinetic energy term. And it tells me that I should scale momentum perpendicular to the Fermi surface as the square of the momentum tangent to the Fermi surface. So then, you know, if I start with a patch, in the RG process, I'm shrinking both the width of the patch and the thickness of the patch. And that's not what I'm doing in a Fermi liquid, where I shrink only the distance towards the Fermi. Now, there is actually a symmetry that guarantees that this scaling between momentum perpendicular to the Fermi surface and tangent to the Fermi surface is exact, that there is no anomalous dimension. And that symmetry I call the shift symmetry. So remember, I chose to expand my fermions about a given point on the Fermi surface. But I could have equally well expanded about a nearby point, and I should get the same physics back. And indeed, there is a symmetry of this theory that guarantees that I do get the same physics back. It's a kind of Galilean symmetry, but not between time and space, but between the two spatial components.
Is it a hidden rotational symmetry in the theory?
I don't think it should be associated with a rotational symmetry, because one could have started with a Fermi surface that's not rotationally invariant, and one would get the same effect of theory. So I think it's really this shift of the base point, invariant under repermetrization of. So what this symmetry guarantees is that the fermion Green's function is a function of only distance to the Fermi surface, but distance as given by the original curvature of the Fermi surface K. So this guarantees that the Fermi surface curvature K does not renormalize. And so the scaling between momenta at tree level is actually exact to all orders. Okay. Let's see how we're doing. Okay. So now let me discuss how to scale time in this theory, having figured out how to scale momentum. And here I'll do something quite unorthodox. I'll choose to scale time in a way as to preserve not the fermion kinetic term, but the gauge fermion coupling. And this immediately gives me dynamical exponent z equal to 3. Which you remember was the result of the RPA calculation. Which is not too surprising, because the RPA calculation did come from the interaction. Now, under such scaling, the fermion kinetic term is actually irrelevant. So it's tempting to just throw it out, but then the theory doesn't have any dynamics at all. So what one can do instead, let's keep this term, but to remind ourselves that it's irrelevant, let's put a coefficient eta in front of it and define the theory via this eta to zero limit. But now that I've done that, also let me rescale the Fermi velocity and Fermi surface curvature out of the problem. It turns out that I have no expansion parameter left in the theory. The only coupling constant floating around, this e squared, has a dimension. It's kind of like a speed of light or a diffusion constant. So there's no dimensionless coupling constant, which means that the theory is strongly coupled. Well, if you don't have a coupling constant, we typically invent one, and the usual crutch is the large N expansion. So in this expansion, one just promotes the fermions to have N flavors, and then one can do the usual settle point approximation. Now, as was shown by Sangsik a few years ago, this large N expansion actually fails for the present problem. I'll explain why it fails in a few slides. But first, let me go a few steps along this large N expansion route, and let me just, let me use it as a sanity check to make sure that the kind of scaling assumptions that I discussed work.
The little a kinetic term went away.
So the detail, yes. A squared. Well, first of all, okay. So that term is even more irrelevant than the fermion kinetic term. So that term can be thrown out from the start. The fermion kinetic term is used to give the gauge boson dynamics, but turns out to be irrelevant also. So you need a little bit of fermion dynamics. It's kind of, you can use, this is kind of like a pole prescription, essentially. It tells you how to close your contour integral.
longer, even though.
Yeah, so maybe we should just postpone to the second.
Is it on your off is it next week?
So let's see, what slide are we on? Yes, somewhere here. 55. the slides become dense and form an extra dimension. Okay, yeah, so maybe...
So we can just do this again next week, same time.
Yeah, that sounds good. So maybe I can give you a bit of a preview. So next time then I'll try to wrap up this first part, I already showed that this simple little theory of a boson coupled to a Fermi surface is strongly coupled. I'll show you how one can use symmetries to make some exact statements about the scaling forms in this two-patch theory, assuming that the two-patch theory is valid. Some future directions in this problem, even though it's a strongly coupled problem, I think we can still learn a lot by thinking about its more weakly coupled relatives, in particular its relatives in dimension larger than 2, and also just about thinking about this two-patch regime in ordinary Fermi-liquid physics that I mentioned earlier. And also, next time I'll tell you about a better controlled deformation of the present problem in 2 dimensions, where we can actually make some progress in calculations. And also, I'll talk about the pairing instability and physics beyond the two-patch theory. Thank you.
Questions for next year.